Hello and welcome to the Emerald City Video Podcast. This is Russ Burlingame. That over there is Zach Roberts.
That?
Well, this and that. I have a little bit of leftover, I think it's just con crud from New York Comic Con, but I'll probably end up clearing my throat and all that kind of glorious stuff.
Lock 'em.
Exactly. Buy my book. Buy my book.
Let's see how many references we can get. We should actually, one thing I'd love to have is like a little reference meter on like references that no one will probably ever get because we are the guys that still talk about The Critic on a constant fucking basis.
That's something we should pull this off of, pull the MP4 off YouTube and add it in post.
Well, it's the one when we finally do the Clerks, the animated series podcast that we keep talking about doing. When we finally do that, that's what we have to like do because that will literally be sort of like bing, 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 bing.
Yeah, right.
Especially if we ever get Kevin on or you know what I mean? Like between the three of us, it'll just be like. So anyway, we actually have a theme this episode.
We do. Instead of talking about specific movies, we're going to do kind of what we did when we were driving to and from New York, which is to talk about kind of the state of cinema and we wanted to talk a little bit about white-on-white crime, because it's a very serious issue. That
Yes, it is. But what about white crime? It's something that you don't talk about.
So that's true. But Zach and I kind of had this conversation at New York Comic Con. Well, not at the con, but in our hotel room the weekend of New York Comic Con. We were like watching whatever happened to me on television.
Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible 2 twice in a row.
Yes, because also out of the 24 channels that we had, it was, you know, as any with any cable in any hotel room that it had, there's like 18 channels of sports. And then there were two channels that for some reason at any given time, because it wasn't the same channels that didn't have audio. And then for some reason, I think it was like TNT always had audio, but seemingly only was playing. It was like a Mission Impossible weekend, except you only played Mission Impossible 2 or 3 or whatever the fuck.
Yeah,
whatever the
fuck I think it was.
I can swear on this podcast. Shit.
but in the course of that, it's funny because we mentioned and kind of we kind of knocked a little bit Catch Me If You Can.
Yes. During
one of our previous podcasts. And then Catch Me If You Can happened to come on television while we were at New York Comic Con.
Yeah.
And so we kind of watched it and remarked on like what was, can you remember exactly what you were saying, Zach? Because it was one of those things where it was like,
well, just how, I mean, one, I mean, it was just, it, you know, everyone always, you know, Leo DiCaprio is like one of the most, at least on Reddit and on the internet, he's one of the most beloved fucking actors. Like, even though he's done very little to ever, actually, for me at least, he was good in What's Eating Gilbert Grape, and then there was a bunch of films he did that he didn't ever deserve to actually win an Academy Award, but everybody was like screaming he deserves to win it because I don't know why.
Because he got bitch slapped by Billy Zane.
I think anybody who gets like it slapped by Billy Zane in any film should never win an Academy Award. Can we make like that some weird unofficial fucking rule? and it's a very short list. It's probably Leo DiCaprio, and I'm sure that somebody gets slapped in. Was it The Phantom?
Yes. I'm sure.
I'm gonna have to. I literally now want to watch that just to see if any slaps anybody. he gives an Archie slap to if you ever seen
there's an outside chance there's an outside chance that he that at some point he slapped Michael J. Fox when he was one of the bullies in Back to the Future.
That's true.
But
but I was talking about I think what you're getting at is that talking about what a horrible character he is.
Yeah.
Because he's ruining people's lives. I mean, this is the one thing about crime capers that unless it's post FDIC ruling, if you're a bank robber who robs, unless you just rob banks, then it's covered as long as you, I mean, I think there's been, I'm trying to remember, there's at least some film recently where you're like, we'll never steal more than $100,000 because that's the only, that's what's covered.
Yeah. I think it was Bandits with
yes.
Billy Bob Thornton. Yeah.
Yes. But fantastic film as well.
Yeah.
Very good film. Not fantastic, but very good film. Maybe it's the fact I've seen it like 17 times. So yeah. At this point, it's only very good. But he's, you know, writing checks on people's banks. And I don't believe that they have like the fraud coverage that they do today. So, yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, the things that he's doing now are is screwing up small businesses and doing all these yeah. things. And he's just not a good character. He's not a good person.
Yeah.
His character is not a good person, but he's completely and totally beloved because he's, you know, he's cute and he's Riley and he also Tom Hanks likes him. So yeah. I guess he must be okay because, you know, that's kind of mandatory.
And I mean, one thing that's certainly, for context, just in case anybody hasn't seen Catch Me If You Can, it's based on a true story. It centers on this character, Frank Abagnale, who was a fraudster who, like he was in a counterfeiting and bleaching checks and other things like that. And he basically posed as a pilot and yep. went around the world kind of kiting other people's checks to pay for an extravagant lifestyle and using like his ability to fly a plane as like a way to stay ahead of the law because it was so hard to track him.
Yeah. You know, and also, I mean, you know, even though it wasn't like there wasn't really security back in the day, but it yeah. also like meant that he could just like walk places and, you know, he also noted that he was, you know, at least, I don't know what, I'm sure it's probably this about the same age, mm-hmm. but like he was 19 years old. Yeah. He was like a teenager throughout the whole thing. So there's also the, he's adorable thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But the whole movie is like a cat and mouse game, as the title implies, between him and the treasury agent played by yeah. Tom Hanks, who is trying to catch him because he's committed hundreds of thousands of dollars in fraud.
Millions, actually.
But in any event,
to IMDb page.
Yeah. There you go. And IMDb is never wrong, which is why Kobe Smulders played a Skrull in Avengers. Oh. I mean, they're really rarely wrong about movies that are actually already out.
Yep.
So I will. But yeah, so, and this I think is something that we were talking about today at lunch, is that this is a symptom of a broader issue in the way Hollywood deals with crime, which is like, if you're an attractive, young, white collar criminal, then like every criminal you do is just fun and sexy and kooky and basically like your massive bank fraud or your arms deal or your drug deal is treated basically in the same way that like, you know, dealing pot in Soul Plane is dealt with if you're a person of color.
See, I'd go with like a toddler stealing a cookie out of the cookie jar is dealt with. Like, it's adorable. He didn't hurt anyone because yeah. it's not a drug. It's not like a, and of course, like drug crimes done by white people, because they're always done, whether it be Tom Cruise, which actually mm-hmm. I haven't seen that film yet, but you know, or even Air America, like the Mel Gibson, Robert Downey Jr., which actually had like a little bit of a harder edge to it.
Yeah.
Because it was at least trying to say something about the CIA drug war or whatever that was going on. You know, you have the fact that, you know, oh, well, no one, never mind. You usually don't see people actually die on screen. But never mind the fact that, like, if you know history well enough, like, people fucking died. Like, lots of people died in that story. And he was directly responsible, or at least very closely indirectly responsible for those people dying. But it's not, you know, it's not New Jack City. So we can play it off as, he's a, you know, he's an anti-hero or something like that, because, you know,
a lovable scamp.
Yes.
But yeah. And so we wanted to talk a little bit about this trope, because without getting too like overtly political, but like just kind of the right amount, there's the fact that you don't see this kind of, like, and yes, there are exceptions to everything. There are plenty of crime movies where white people are treated as heroes or as tragic or villainous figures for being criminals. There's also I wouldn't say plenty. There's a handful of movies where characters of color get similar kind of like, oh, but he's doing it for the right reason, and so it's funny.
But it's done. It's usually, like, I mean, like the only one I can like immediately thinking of is like Denzel Washington.
John Q.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I'm trying to think of anyone.
There, I mean, there are a handful of like, I mean, the part of it is that when this happens outside of like, when this happens outside of white people,
yeah,
it tends to be screwball comedies.
It's kind of a, for some reason, that's like either a fantastic name for an article or a book. When this happens outside, or just outside of white people.
Yeah.
But stories, like, stories from the inner city.
Because that's the only place that there are non-white people.
Exactly.
But no, when you have a Frank Abagnale or a, you know, take your pick of whatever the guy's name is in Lord of War is a good example. And, you know, it's not uncommon. You can have like a serious drama that explores like what drives him to do this. What's the concept, you know, and like, and it kind of, and these people are played in a sympathetic light and most of their crimes are played for laughs. But like, even though it's a quasi-serious, like, you know, Catch Me If You Can is a Spielberg movie, so there's a lot of earnestness and you know, that kind of. But like, when you see it, like, on the rare occasion that non-white people get to do it, it turns out to be like, don't be a menace to South Central while drinking your juice in the hood.
Yeah, yeah, you know? It's usually a farce or it's a, you know, a satire of some level. Which, I mean, that film itself was a satire of, you know, at the 12 different films that it hit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like I said, outside of the John Q film.
Yeah. I mean, they're super rare. And when you get some of them like John Q, it tends to be like, I am black, black is coded for poor. And so,
it should be noted, it's Denzel Washington, who is one of the very few black actors who's allowed to play this role. He's allowed to play the, like, to me in a lot of films, he's almost interchangeable. With some, obviously some dialogue changes, with Bruce Willis to an extent. Like, I think that Denzel Washington could have done a great Die Hard reboot. Mm-hmm. No one listen to that, please. Because I feel like it'll happen now. If somebody goes, somebody in Hollywood just was like, wait, what? What was that?
That was they already did it. It's The Equalizer. I mean, that's pretty much.
Like, but that was its own story before, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. But yeah, so the larger point though is that there are a handful that exist for like not white people doing not white collar crimes.
Yeah.
But like when it's white people committing like financial crimes or business crimes of some kind, there's just a subgenre of them. Like we had like the four that we wanted to kind of look at in various ways, shapes, and forms, but you could like fill a book with a list of like movies where like the criminal is lovable and not really hurting anybody.
It's also interesting, like all the films that we're talking about, which I guess we can just say because it's this sort of thing, is, you know, Wolf of Wall Street, War Dogs, Catch Me If You Can, and then somewhat counter, Lord of War. I mean, Lord of War is based, I mean, it's not based on a true story like the other three are. It's based on stories. Like there's a character that exists like this.
Yeah.
You know, kind of. But it's interesting that so many of these characters that in real life are, you know, again, I mean, I guess, was it American Made is the Tom Cruise one as well. It could be added to this list. Just neither of us have seen it. It's not, that's, I think, the only reason why it's not on the list. But same thing, Air America, like based on, you know, based on true story, like any number of these things, like they're all based on true stories. I find them, I can't think of any black or Black or Hispanic stories that are based on true stories.
Yeah. And here's the thing, we one of the things that, we're kind of glossing over as we get down the rabbit hole a little bit is, when we talked about this, it's not like there aren't a million movies about how drugs affect Latin American and Black communities. But specifically, we're talking about the fact that every movie about Black or Hispanic criminals is all about how terrible this is and how it destroys their communities. Yeah. And you see consequences. And basically the lesson here is like, stay in line, stay in your lane, be a good person. Whereas with white and with white anti-heroes or whatever you want to call these people, so often you get, no, crime is kind of sexy and fun, and as long as you don't pull the trigger, nobody gets hurt.
Yeah, I mean, there's that vague, no, you shouldn't do this, but it's kind of, again, it's like the kid shouldn't, the child should not steal the cookie from the cookie jar, but he did it, and what are you gonna do?
Yeah, and it's like, you get the, we talked a little bit at lunch about how Catch Me If You Can is an interesting example, because there are filmmaking choices made in the third act of that movie that specifically work to highlight the kind of story that we're talking about, the kind of trope that we're talking about. Because in Catch Me If You Can, he gets caught, goes to jail briefly, and then once he's an adult, they essentially recruit him to come work for the Treasury Department and catch people like him.
Yep.
And after his first week at the job, he realizes that he hates having a desk job and he hates being stuck in one town and he's miserable and his whole life seems small and pathetic and he wants to like do something. So he asks Tom Hanks's character to hang out with him over the weekend, and Tom Hanks kind of blows him off because like he's got a family and he's got a kid who he never gets to see. And like, you're really just some dude who I arrested. And then what they do with it is, he goes out, impersonates a pilot again, flies someplace, has a crazy adventure over the weekend, and then comes back and goes back to his day job. Yep. And they play it up as like, this is his redemption story, and as soon as he comes back through that door, he's a hero. Yep. And, you know, and
Tom Hanks' character even smiles, like, knowingly, I know what you did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, And here's the thing, like, from a filmmaking point of view, Spielberg could easily have cut that, which, first of all, I assume it's apocryphal anyway, because I don't imagine that he was working for the Treasury and getting away with these kinds of crimes. I think it just served the kind of story that Spielberg was telling to do it.
Yep.
But when you make that decision as a director, it's like you're taking the consequences totally off the table. And you're making this a cute story about how he can have his cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, if you cut the film, you know, 5 minutes earlier, and basically he has to live with the consequences of his, like, life choices. Yeah. And those consequences, even if they're small, it's like he's stuck at a job that he hates. He's not making a lot of money. He's not having his sexy life. He doesn't get to go do whatever the hell he wants on the weekends. Like, if you cut that movie off 5 minutes earlier and you don't have that whole like absurd thing of him like running back to the office late, then it's a totally different movie, because the culminating event of the movie, the thing that it all builds to, is the realization that he has done something irreparable to his life.
Yeah.
But literally you get to that point and then you like undermine it, which is the same. It's the problem that I always had with John Ford's Grapes of Wrath adaptation. You know, the idea that in order to fit his conservative worldview, he takes like the ending of the book and then he just has to tack on an extra like minute and a half of that Ma Jode speech about how like everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Because we're Americans.
Yeah.
And it's like, as a director, you make these decisions to like, do you cut it at the point where you're saying something, or do you cut it at the point where it's narratively what the audience is expecting?
Yeah. With these actors and these characters from a Spielberg film, you know, I mean, if this is a, you know, even a Frank Darabont, you know, not even, you don't even have to go that dark. You just have to go like somebody like Frank Darabont. It's a different, you know, it's a different story. Or, you know, I mean, God, you know, I mean, can you imagine like David Fincher having fun with that script?
Yeah.
I'm just watching Mindhunters. So it's like, literally, I'm like, oh, that would actually be fascinating. I'd love to see that. Cause it'd be just a stuff. I mean, the one thing should add, I mean, it's this, that, you know, as we, you know, bash the at least the kind of the moral of Catch Me If You Can, damn well edited film.
Yeah.
Everybody is in it is doing what they do. Like every single actor in the film is Tom Hanks doing Tom Hanks and Leo doing Leo and, you know, which I forgot, Christopher Walken is the dad.
Oh, yeah,
got right. a nomination for it. You know, everybody's very good in it. And this is, you know, it's actually kind of the bell curve top for me of yeah. Spielberg. It's literally kind of where he goes. And then I don't even know. I'd have to check what the next film after that was.
Crystal Skull, I think. I'm not even joking. I think that's the next.
Oh my God. Also, I'm sorry. I'm looking at his IMDb profile and it's, I'm not kidding. Executive producer for Real Steel 2, executive producer for Gremlins 3, executive producer for the reboot of Animaniacs, executive producer for Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, executive producer for Men in Black, Untitled Men in Black spinoff, executive producer for Untitled Indiana Jones project. And you're like, oh, okay. So that's, oh, I'm sorry. I missed the executive producer of basically Adventures of Tintin 2. And also Adventures Bumblebee. Of Tintin 3.
Bumblebee, the Transformers spinoff.
Oh my, that's true.
Yeah. there. But yeah, let me see. Yeah, he has like 9,000 executive producer credits. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, he's produced, you know, some of the, all, basically all the fucking films that you'd, actually the Terminal was the next thing. That
yeah, I actually just got there myself. And yeah, Terminal wasn't terrible. It was kind of there. War of the Worlds, I actually quite liked, at least at the time. It's been probably 10 years since I watched it.
I liked it for what it was like one of those I liked it for what it was sort of thing. And, you know, I think it was one of Cruise's better thing. I mean, you know, Munich was.
You mean Hanks?
What's that?
Hanks. Oh, never mind. Yeah, Tom Cruise. I was thinking The Terminal still.
Although I kind of want to see that, see that Tom Hanks film now.
I would love
just him running. I want to see Tom Hanks from like Volcano. Like I want to see, or you know, Man with Red Shoe, or you know, even Big. I want to see that Tom Hanks do that film. There'd be a lot more flailing of the arms.
It's very true.
But anyway, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if we want to go through the other films or kind of talk about, I mean, one of the big things.
Yeah. I mean, I do think I agree with you that we've kind of spent a lot of time on Catch Me If You Can, because we both recently watched it, but it's kind of the least tropey and least bad and least offensive of these kinds of movies.
Yeah. I mean, I will say though, it's even if it ended with him kind of doing this job that he kind of goes back and forth with, you know, this kind of menial job for a guy that spent, you know, three or whatever years of his life, like running the country, you know, hanging out with women, you know, and doing everything he wanted to do is like anything that a teenager might ever fucking dream doing. Going and spending the rest of his life in the Treasury office would just be, you know, a thing. And then, you know, I feel like he would eventually, if the story just was allowed to continue, you feel like, well, this is a cycle that they didn't complete. And then they cut to title cards and it's like, he's a multimillionaire. Everybody's fine. Tom Hanks and him, the Treasury agent and him are still friends. He advises, you know, multinational corporations on these things. And you're like, okay. Like, so he literally was never punished for all these crimes that he did.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't even have he's a multimillionaire. Oh, by the way, he also paid back his, you know, the people that he fucked over, you know, oh, by the way, he never, you know, I mean, I still remember like you know, I think the big thing that I said, why I said, wow, he's a fucking asshole, was because he lied to this girl that fell in love with him. And then she basically had kind of the choice of, well, you can either run away with me and live your life on the lam for the rest of your life. And she was just, you know, she was just like your stereotypical average American girl, like, you know, or I think American. I think she was American.
Maybe I think not. So.
I have to rat you out to the FBI and destroy, you know, kill my, you know, basically imprison my, I mean, like you set that up for that woman and they basically portrayed her. They didn't portray her as like evil or, you know, or, you know, vindictive or anything like that. But there was at least the moment where he goes, oh, whatever her name is and like drives off. And it's like, you destroyed that woman's life. Like at least for the next decade, she's like, what the, I mean, you know, maybe in the true life story, they got back together or something, or maybe she never existed. I don't know. But like, they certainly, you know,
I bet probably that one.
But it's like, you know, there's this whole side thing where it's like, they don't necessarily, it's because it's interesting. I mean, Spielberg does this a lot with his characters where you don't necessarily, I mean, like you think about Indiana Jones and like his women, because I mean, at least even in the fourth one, they bring back. Yeah. Was scoring. I mean, like, wait, you left me? Like, it just, you know, I mean, and so they have these likable characters that aren't James Bond. You know, he has action, kind of action-y type people who aren't James Bond. It's like, James Bond is a womanizer. There's just, that's his character. I feel like most of the women in the films, at least the last, you know, since even Pierce Brosnan, you know, like, I feel like most of the female characters have a really good idea of either they know of him as James Bond, a womanizer, like there's a joke there, or they know what they're getting into, or
they know what they signed up for.
Exactly. You know what you signed up for. So anyway, but I just like my microphone allows me to do the deep voice really well.
Nice.
You know, I mean, they provide all these moments where he's a really terrible person, really a terrible character, and then like just kind of let him get away with it. And there's no, there's no redemption. I mean, there's not even a moment because especially this film, it cuts so much. It's like, it's actually one of Spielberg's probably quicker films editing wise. Cause I mean, he's like the master of the long take. They don't like, they're like, oh, he had this moment with this woman and then next scene and he's off on the new next adventure, which understandably story-wise they have to do that. But it's also like I really want, you know, obviously it's a Spielberg film, so you're never going to have it, but like, I want at least a little bit darker. Like the fact that, you know, I don't want a scene where she's like weeping uncontrollably alone in a room and drinking or something. or I don't want the same for him necessarily, but like, I feel like at least give me one more scene where he's like, I feel very poorly about what I've done, you know? And I get it. He's a teenager. So, you know, that is allowed too much, but I mean, I also, it is one of those things. I mean, this is a completely different side thing with teenage characters where I go, I don't know. I was never that teenager who like,
didn't know
he's right a teenager. He just gets away with it. He's just fine. It was a youthful indiscretions. Yeah. I still remember every single fucking thing and single person that I wronged from high school. Maybe it's just me. Maybe that's the reason I drink. But but like, I don't know that many teenagers that are like intelligent and well thought out
that's part of the thing with Catch Me If You Can is the fact that you can't really give him a pass for being a teenager when clearly, like, in order to pull off the schemes that he's pulling off, he has like intellect and
I mean, clearly he's a genius on some level. I mean, like there's like no doubt on that, and you know, but anyway.
But so there's that. I mean, and again, like that movie is a lot less offensive than when you get into like The Wolf of Wall Street or War Dogs.
Well, I mean, Wolf of Wall Street, he's you know, it's one of those weird films. It's like, for me, it's like a Oh Lucky Man, or what is it? I'm trying to remember the pattern. Oh Lucky Man to or If to Oh Lucky Man to oh my God, what's the Kubrick film?
Cockroach Orange.
really both liked that Clockwork. Remember If and Oh Lucky Man, two films that like 80% of the, 95% of the world population has never even heard of. But
I have If right over there though.
Yeah, no, I have it somewhere too. But
here's my thing. To be fair, I was trying to think of another Lindsay, whatever. Like
it's Britannia Hospital is the fourth in the. It's a little bit so yeah. Anyway, we should actually do a trilogy thing on that. But the whole thing is that If to Oh Lucky Man are Lindsay Anderson films played the main characters played by Lindsay or played by Malcolm McDowell, and then there's
A Clockwork Orange.
Also, main character Malcolm McDowell. And if you watch all three of them in a row, you're like, "Oh my God, this is the arc of this character." Mm-hmm. To me, it's almost like, even though,
and then it's really weird at the end when it goes to Tank Girl.
Yeah.
Anyway, or the Halloween reboot.
Or any film he's ever done.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not any film he's ever done. He kind of always plays Malcolm McDowell. He's one of those actors. But which reminds me, he's one of those weird actors that's kind of drifted. Like, I'm trying to remember what the last thing he was in.
The last thing I saw him in, I know he's been in something since then, but the last thing I saw him in was like Heroes.
Yeah. But I wonder who replaced him in that. Because I always feel like, anyway. Yeah, but yes, I support that. You know, it's almost like Catch Me If You Can. He wasn't caught. Obviously, the decades don't really work out that well. But well, maybe they do. I don't know. But like Wolf of Wall Street is kind of like, well, he never really learned from his lessons, and clearly he just went into Wall Street because he's, you know, a guy that doesn't have really, you know, scruples, and Wall Street is the place for him to go. And then he started, and again, Leo DiCaprio plays the same character. So it kind of works out. It's again, you know, almost everything we said about Catch Me If You Can kind of has the same thing. There's almost nothing good about DiCaprio's character in Wolf of Wall Street. Again, another character based on a real story, based on a book, based on, you know, everything. Based on a guy who's, you know, spoilers if you haven't watched it, but I mean, I don't know if you could watch that film done by a American director and go, well, there's no way he's going to end in a pool of his own blood.
Yeah.
Even if you don't know the true story or whatever, but you know, he goes to a white collar prison, literally is portrayed in a wide shot of him playing tennis in a white outfit. Mm-hmm. And then basically we know he's out of jail because when the film came out, he was like on CNN and shit.
Yeah.
Again, you know, I don't think he ended up with much money at the end, but I'm sure he made some cash from, from the film in one way or another. And you know, once a Wall Street crook, you know, it's not like they ever fucking go away. Steve Rattner right now, who, you know, destroyed millions of human beings' lives, is now on Morning Joe and a celebrated expert on whatever the fuck he's an expert on. And also helped destroy you know, the auto industry and during the Obama administration. So everybody loves him because he's a white collar criminal, and you know, everybody loves a white collar criminal with a redemption story. Either way, everybody loves white collar criminals.
It's exhausting to watch these films for me because I don't love these people at all. No. And like, even a movie like Catch Me If You Can, where like it's entertaining and he's depicted in an entertaining fashion, and so you're like, oh, I kind of enjoy the ride of
really
this movie.
Should enjoy. Yeah, really should like this guy.
But it's just kind of like, yeah, that's not like. He's a terrible person who like really profoundly negatively affects the lives of those around him.
And they really, I mean, the crazy thing about both of these films too, like I could like these characters more if I didn't know that they were real life characters. I could understand it because I mean, like, look at, we all love a good bank robbery film, even if somebody gets, you know, killed or whatever. They're not they're lovable characters, but they're like, you know, there's a weird Robin Hood-esque sort of thing to this. But these people aren't Robin. They're stealing from the poor and giving to themselves, you know.
Yeah. Like, do you think that's really what this boils down to, is that this trope is older than we kind of give it credit for, and really it comes from our fascination with like Bonnie and Clyde and you know, that
first
sort
off,
of
they, those people like Bonnie and Clyde and so many of those characters, they're, you know, what is it, Pretty Boy Floyd? I mean, like, these are characters that are very complicated, but at some level, I mean, there's fucking folk songs about how they gave, whether it's true or not, like our cultural knowledge of them is that they would then in turn, you know, even it just throw some money at the poor, you know, poor person walk by, leave a what's the Woody Guthrie song, leave a $1,000 bill underneath their plate. Even though I've always wondered how exactly does, first off, $1,000 bill, not plausible, but also like how exactly does some poor guy deal with $1,000 bill? Like how does he walk into a bank? He can't spend it at the corner store. How much gingham can he buy? That was a cross reference Bill Hicks joke.
And I approve.
if we ever actually get a budget for these shows, we need like the pop-up video things. That's what we need. Like, that was a Bill Hicks joke from
Explain Our References album. And then the people who listen to the podcast as a podcast are all going to be like, what the fuck is this
is the boom, boom, boom. And also everybody who watches the podcast would go, wait, what the fuck was pop-up videos? I don't know what that is. Because we're old.
That is very true.
But anyway, but you know, I don't think that I don't know. I mean, there's definitely a comparison, and I think there's a lead in because our criminal heroes now, like basically after this gritty 70s era films, the Scorsese films and stuff like that, you know, Dog Day Afternoon and things like that, which, but the 80s, you know, basically glorified everything to do with Wall Street and, you know, almost, especially during the 80s, literally everyone that was probably known by name on Wall Street was at some level eventually found out to be a criminal.
Yeah.
Like, it's not really a generalization. I mean, I literally can't think of a Wall Street person out of the 80s that you knew from the 80s that wasn't a criminal, or at least turned out to be one. I mean, one's our president now. Well, he's in a Wall Street, he's a real estate person. Same difference. But it is interesting how they've done this. And this, you know, I mean, this, I think one of the things, and this is kind of maybe a weird segue, unless you have something else on Wolf of Wall Street, obviously we'll go back to it, but it makes me think of one of the reasons why we started, we've talked about this idea for a long time. We've always kind of talked about the idea of these, you know, white collar criminals in film are always portrayed as, you know, these weird anti-heroes. And some weird like Robin Hoods without actually giving the money to anybody, which is like weird, like, because it literally is that same almost meme where they're like, they're figuring out how to steal money from poor people to give to themselves, like not even like they're being like, oh, we're donating to, you know, it's not even like nowadays where you have billionaires who are like, well, we're stealing poor money from the poor, but hey, we're giving it back to poor people through our foundation so we don't have to pay taxes. Mark Zuckerberg. We talked about this because it was like, to make it dark for a moment, not that this isn't dark, but is talked about this within the guise of the heroin I want to say crisis because that's what everybody says, but epidemic, in the fact that, again, you know, the news media and the media in general, every single white person who has been, you know, hooked on heroin is it's not by the fault of their own. It's these evil corporations that are doing this. And it's like, or it's, you know, or more importantly, it's not even the evil corporations that it's poverty. It's because they're poor that they got stuck on this, and
I know that.
I guess they didn't know better. They didn't, you know, they're not smart enough to not, I mean, there's all these like
that poor destitute Rush Limbaugh.
Exactly. Yeah. But no, but it's, you know, Hillbilly Elegy, all these stories. I mean, there was the entire meme of the 2016 election was that, you know, I mean, even when Donald Trump stood on stage, I was there in New Hampshire and talked about these poor people who were not poor as in financially poor, but these unfortunate souls, to steal a line from Little Mermaid,
like you do.
Sorry, I just had this moment of like of seeing Donald Trump singing as "Poor Ursula. Unfortunate Souls," like you.
I think she's less fat and has better
less,
hair, but
less evil too. No. I mean, all she did was steal someone's voice. I mean, for That's fuck's true. Sake. But
I picture her little garden of souls. The you know the little like the yes, little, yeah. and they all wearing MAGA hats.
I don't have mine, but but although I feel like I should get like a little one for Tom Servo, but it's the fact that like you know even Donald Trump like was on stage in New Hampshire talking about how these poor people and whatever, and you know again white people even when they do crimes, you know I mean fucking what's the most popular show of the last decade outside of The Wire, Breaking Bad, like
yeah.
Horrible. Like I admit I've only seen the first three episodes. I'm the one guy in America. But one white guy in America from a rural area or whatever, but hasn't seen more than three episodes or one episode, and I don't really care to see more because this trope is that
yeah,
I know that he pays, I know that there's like trials and tribulations of his life and everything like that. But for fuck's sake, he literally because he's poor, he's decided, you know what I'm gonna do? Is I'm going to actively use my intelligence to destroy everyone else in the fucking county that I live in's lives by making pure, unadulterated fucking drugs to make sure to hook everybody on it. And I don't know, I haven't seen it more. Do you spend time with the misery that he builds? And does he like
Yeah,
you do.
Yeah, I mean to the credit of that show, like the middle, you know, I think it's seven seasons long, and I want to say seasons 3 through 5 are basically just him becoming a more and more irredeemable bastard while everybody around him suffers or dies, and they do have like plot armor for members of his immediate family, like the he never like they never really put lie to this idea that he's secretly doing it all for his family because he's going to die. And I think that the idea was that if anything actually happened to his family during the run of the show, it would mean like you would have what essentially amounts to the last season and this kind of crisis of conscience and like the questioning your whole ethos. Cause of course in the last season he gets caught and he loses all of his money and now he's just,
spoilers.
Yeah, but now he's just like this drug dealer on the run, and like the criminals want to kill him, and the cops want to arrest him, and blah blah blah. Like, so like, and to an extent, like that, like the, he is a the first couple seasons, he's a very good example of this trope because it really is like a lot of it's played for laughs, and there's not a whole lot of like, holy shit, this is what the crystal meth, like. Epidemic is doing to people. But I will give him credit that like as the show wore on, a lot of it was basically and like his wife, and it's funny because of course the people who love this show hate his wife because she's ostensibly like a shrill harpy who just yells at him, but like a lot of the time like she finds out what he's doing, and like most of her yelling is about the fact that like what the fuck makes you think that you have the right to do this,
yeah,
you know.
But it's that whole thing where, you know, if anybody, you know, anybody listening is old enough to remember the crack epidemic, which we never called the crack crisis, literally never once heard it, even though it has a better term.
It does.
It sounds kind of like a video game, actually.
It does.
But kind of want to write it. But I mean, we had the film that the one film that came out of that crisis that we can, that entire fucking decade that we remember probably more than anything else for me, New Jack City, which holy mother of God, that film. And this is actually appropriate to talk about within the guise of Emerald City Video, because this is a little something that like in almost every video store that I ever went to, I don't remember the shelf being that enormous in Blockbusters usually, but in independent video stores, there was a free shelf that you could go in and rent the select, like, I mean, at, was it West Coast Video? I don't know if you ever, like, there was one in Bloorton, New York.
I never went, but I'm aware of it.
I think actually my dog's vet is actually in that space now, right. Which is actually kind of funny now I think about it. They would have probably 30 or 40 films. It would change out a little bit, and it would be your kind of, you know, most of it would be your like ABC, you know, Tuesday night movie about some, you know, person learning a thing. But the one like mainstream film that was a narrative budgeted film was New Jack City. Mm-hmm. It was there, which always perplexed me to like hell, because if it wasn't an R-rated film, it damn well fucking should have been. Because that film was, I mean, I saw it. I don't know if I saw it when I'd have to actually check whether I saw it when it came out, because, but I mean, I certainly saw it right away, 1991. I probably saw it right when it came out. But like, y'all should check out the trailer on that film just to like, and also you should watch it. It's one of those films that like, it's also one of the first films that I really can think of that had, I mean, holy shit, like looking at the cast of this film, Vanessa Williams, Wesley Snipes, Ice-T, Chris Rock, Mario Van Peebles, Russell Wong, Flav, Fab, basically every hip hop artist you can possibly think of was in the film. And it was a pretty good film. It was actually directed by Mario Van Peebles. But it was fucking dark. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, think about The Wire, and it was very much along those lines. Obviously not as good, because nothing can be as good as The Wire. That's also like the one show in America. So that I haven't seen the rest. I haven't seen more than one episode of The Wire. It looks really good, but A Homicide: Life on the Streets is the best fucking show ever. I'm sorry. And I will fucking fight you over that. But by the way, it's out on DVD now, and I have not actually purchased it yet. What the fuck is wrong with me?
Shout Factory was supposed to send me a copy, and I haven't received it. Again, we need
to.
Them,
you know what we need to do is we need to promise that we'll do a we'll do a episode by episode podcast of it, which we will do. It'll be like your Cheers blend one. Yeah. Be like 84.
We'll
be
in our
60s and be like, well, and now we're doing the Homicide: Life on the Street, the movie, the one where the lieutenant dies. spoilers, but but yeah, I don't know.
But aren't they all technically in an autistic child's snow globe, because those people all showed up in X-Files?
Well, I mean, half of them are on Law and Order, and half of them have appeared like. Well, at least Munch survives on, which is hilarious to watch. Well, also, all more importantly, and of course, I don't have a copy of it, because why the fuck would I have a copy of my film? But Munch is in my film, and so is actually Ice-T. So it actually brings it back to two films that we just talked about.
There you go.
Best Democracy Money Can Buy has a tie, has a direct connection. No connection, no need to jump through Kevin Bacon or anything to New Jack City.
There you go.
Good to know. But anyway, but black people don't get to have the same redemption stories, like even in drug movies, which is usually a pretty big thing. I mean, the amount of fucking coke and the way, I mean, you know, I mean, it's easy to say, I mean, like the way that cocaine is glorified in film versus almost every other drug imaginable, even pot, like, which is now, even pot nowadays, like cocaine is still like cool because even if you get to do it off a hooker's ass, you get to do it off of whatever, you know, there's always some interesting thing going on with it. It's not like, I can't remember the last film that I saw where cocaine was handed out or, you know, on a table and people are like, oh my God, run out. But I can think of films where pot was portrayed that way, which is perplexing.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But I mean, I think again that it all kind of ties into the same thing that like, if the criminal's a white guy, then they're secretly Han Solo, you know?
Yeah. and if they're a black guy, they're Lando. And that actually is a perfect fucking metaphor because we all know George Lucas is a huge fucking racist. And if you didn't see, the first three of the trilogy, whatever the fuck they are, the prequels, but you would know that. But you know, yeah. But you know, I mean, there's also the other tropes, which not even just like financial is the, you know, the gun runners, which again, I don't think we even thought through that much on this, but I mean, it works the same way. I mean, you think about all the films about African drug runners, or I'm sorry, African gun runners, with, you know, in literal African, like in Africa, not African-American drug gun runners. And they're fucking like monsters. Like they are the worst human beings fucking imaginable. But two redeemable, you know, Jewish kids from, I forget where the fuck they're even from, figure out this website in War Dogs, and they are able to, during the Iraq War, figure out how to, you know, get gun contract, you know, get weapons contracts with the United States government and make all this money. And then one of them has a close call and then realizes the wrong that he's done. But don't worry, he only spends a year and a half in jail, even though hundreds, if not thousands, of people have died because of what he's done. But everything's okay. I kind of actually want to do the trailers for these films now in the, oh, and then there's an irredeemable scam.
It's like honest trailers, but like... But instead of just bitching about Superman movies, you're talking about something that actually, you know.
Just make everything. Was it, there's that fantastic trailer of The Shining that's recut to do romantic comedy. I would love to keep the same trailers, but just change the trailer voice. Or at most of these films don't have a trailer voice. But like add a trailer voice of like the, oh, but then he's... But he like found his true love with a Russian voiceover stripper.
I'm sure I must have shown you this. The trailer for The Shining, where they recut it as like a 90s like family romantic kind of comedy.
Yeah.
And it was they played that song that was in the About a Boy trailer that was like in every fucking trailer for 3 years around that time.
Yeah.
Grab your things. I'm gonna whatever. I shouldn't finish singing anything, first of all, because I can't sing, and second of all, because God knows if I have seven notes out of a song, YouTube won't let us try to monetize
it. I know, anything. I literally was going to pull up the trailer for that, and then I realized exactly what you said. And I'm like, nope, not going to do that, because we tried making the show, you know, have something other than just our lovely white faces.
Yeah.
This is the White Guilt Hour. Like all the podcasts that I do, even my photojournalism podcast is me ranting about fucking white people. which I love that I have reviews on my other podcast saying, it's like, I really wish he just wouldn't rant about police violence as much as he does.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe if the police stopped being violent towards you, you wouldn't have...
I mean, the funny thing is that's also not something that's any different. I mean, like, it is amazing that we watch and we've been bred. I mean, like, from Die Hard on to everything. Well, I mean, before that, I mean, obviously this is a legacy. Yeah. It's not even Die Hard doesn't even do it that much. But like police, like, and I always joke that, you know, it doesn't matter, because people are like, oh, well, the cop that shot the black kid was that black himself. And I'm like, he was blue. Like that's the race. But I mean, police are able to get away with crimes more than anything fucking imaginable. And it's amazing that, you know, we root for them as they're like, wait a minute, you didn't need to actually.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a whole kind of other, I want to have a conversation about anti-heroes and like, kind of toxic masculinity because I'm doing an interview that like a proper interview for my day job that will tie into those themes this week. And I kind of want to like drop a few minutes of that interview into an Emerald City podcast just as a supplemental thing. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you can certainly draw a direct line between what we're talking about tonight and like the Punisher.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's an omnicidal maniac. Like, if you piss him off, he will try to murder you or, like, you know, even if you look at Daredevil, it's like, yeah, I'm going to put you in a position where you don't believe that I should be allowed to kill criminals without due process. I'm going to duct tape a gun to your hand, chain you to a pipe, and force you to either murder me or let me murder others.
Yeah.
And it's like, but he's the good guy, right? And that's super cool and not at all disturbing.
Yeah. but I mean, similarly, you don't even have to, I mean, you don't even have to go so far as the Punisher. You just go to any random cop movie ever.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that's what I was gonna say. Literally every cop show where it's like the glee that you're supposed to take in finding ways around due process and people's rights and, you know.
Yeah. And that's also, it is one of the few, like, you know, it is one of the few tropes where it doesn't matter if it's a black guy, a white guy or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a cop that is allowed to do it, you know, which is an interesting difference between, because, you know, the last thing that we did was about the Jackie Chan film. And literally he would probably be completely like 100% justified snapping the neck of every single one of those people that he dealt with, pretty much, because they're all either IRA bombers. They're, you know, horrible, basically all horrible people. But he doesn't. The only people he even slightly kills is, you know, the literal actual people who killed his daughter. Spoilers like hell. But I think that you probably, once you get 5 minutes into that film, you're like, this is how this is going to end.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no, like, big thing.
I mean, once he sets the fake car bomb 10 minutes into the movie and has the little note inside the gas tank that says, give me the names. It's like, obviously he's not going to get through this whole movie without the names.
Yeah. Like, it'd be a very disappointing film. Yeah. Like, wait, didn't actually need the name? Which actually would be interesting about a film about itself, where he's just like, no, I realize the wrongs that I have gone through.
Well, I mean,
will allow the judicial system to go through its...
There's an element of Limey, you think about it.
Yeah.
Like, because the Limey has the, like, the spoilers for 25-year-old movie or whatever, but it has the scene where he realizes that, like, oh shit, it's my lifetime of bad decisions that led to my daughter's death, and so maybe I shouldn't murder this dude because he killed her over a misunderstanding, when the misunderstanding is literally entirely my own fault. There is a movie that exists out there that plays with that.
You know, I think we could go on about War Dogs more, because it actually, it's not a good, for me at least, it's not a good film. It has a lot to do with the fact I don't like, pretty much, as actors, I don't really like anyone in the film, especially in the roles that they're playing.
Yeah.
But also everybody in the film is, unlike Wolf of Wall Street, and even, you know, and Catch Me If You Can, these are likable characters, or at least supposed to be likable characters.
Right.
Which actually is interesting. There's the connection between Wolf of Wall Street and War Dogs and, what's his name?
Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill. Yeah. Not Seth Rogen. But that's how I always think
that's
about
how
him
we should credit him on the poster.
Not Seth Rogen, which I'm perfectly fine with that. The two characters are, there's one character, Jonah Hill, who's just irredeemably terrible, and is fine with that. He's like, he's supposed to play like your high school friend who like was fun in high school and kind of like, oh, he's the guy that gets into trouble and he drags a really boring, you know, nerdy kid into trouble sort of thing. And, but gets him to have his like, you know, best high school memory sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then there's the guy that's just like, financially not doing well and decides that gun running is the next option because I get to give my really overly hot wife everything she ever wanted, and for some reason she thinks that everything just magically money is just pouring in, because I guess every wife in every single one of these movies is unbelievably fucking dumb. Like, except for, which is our kind of alternative film, Lord of War. She actually basically breaks down the whole fucking film, she breaks down the whole storyline. And this is the one film, I really dig this film. It's by, it's by the guy that wrote The Truman Show. I think it's his first direct film as director.
I think so.
I think it was like relatively right after.
It was like 2004 or five, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I, I really dig this film. I've seen anything. I mean, not only cinematically, it's really well done. It's interesting to watch. I mean, the opening sequence is probably one of the best fucking opening sequences you could ever have for a fucking film.
Yeah.
Because it literally follows a shell like through production all the way into the gun of a young kid who's shooting somebody. And like the characters are very briefly enjoyable.
Yeah.
And he loses, and again, spoilers, but this is again,
yeah.
Go see the film. Spoilers aren't going to be, I feel like once you get the vibe of this film,
yeah.
Like you're gonna, if like 20 minutes into the film, you're like, this doesn't end well. Yeah. But because I also believe it opens that way. Like, I think it actually tells you that it's one of those films of flashbacks, but yeah. It's been like a year since I've seen it. But it, there's, everybody gets punished in one way, yeah. shape, and form, even if they're not literally spending the rest of their life in jail or shot in the back of the head, even yeah. if they don't get the comeuppings that they should, you know, morally do. But like, it is relatively realistic in that sense where, like, I mean, because Wolf of Wall Street, War Dogs, yeah. and Catch Me If You Can, I mean, War Dogs, one character I think spends like, they're like the subtitle thing is he spent a year in jail and the other character spent seven. And you're like,
yeah.
he literally had several people murdered. And you're like,
yeah. oh, but it was in Eastern Europe. Thousands of people. Yeah. yeah.
I mean, not even the people that his guns killed and everything like that. Like yeah. literally people died because of what he did.
Right.
But, in Lord of War, it, actually deals has some good realism to it about, you know, gun running. It's kind of the really great, it'd be almost, if we could also do like a side thing, maybe we'll do it like in a year or something like that. Literally War Dogs and Lord of War as like two films, except most of the time we do a film that, you know, like a film that you're going to watch and a film that we'd recommend. And except I wouldn't recommend War Dogs to.
I can't think of anyone. Yeah.
Maybe somebody I really hate. I don't know.
A fun side note about Lord of War. It is not his directorial debut. His directorial debut was actually the first film that he wrote before Truman Show, which is Gattaca.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Yeah.
He also directed Simone.
Oh, yeah.
And then Lord of War. But what's really interesting to me is the movie that he wrote immediately prior to Lord of War after Simone, which is The Terminal.
Nah.
It all comes back to Spielberg. Connected.
Oh, more importantly, it all comes back to Tom fucking Hanks. but yeah. I out of all these films, I recommend that you need to go see or go rent Lord of War. I don't know at this point where you can get it, because it's one of those films that, again, which really pisses me off about this, like kind of this list that we talk about. Well, Wolf of Wall Street, War Dogs, Catch Me If You Can, and Lord of War. Like, Lord of War is the film that we'd tell people in, you know, I don't think we did because of years and whatever. It was moderately new when we would have worked at the video store and all this shit.
Yeah.
But like, it's the type of film that we would have been like super excited about. Oh, you want to see this film? And you're like, oh no,
I remember hand selling the hell out of that movie when I was working at Blockbuster.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, Blockbuster would be more this type of store that you'd have to kind of hand sell it. Because, you know, you wouldn't go into, you know, Emerald City is more of the type of store that people would go in for it. But even though, I mean, it was a relatively mainstream release, it's, you know, Nick Cage was not the current Nick Cage. He is Nick Cage that was, you know, probably in the realm of, I still believe he's a national treasure, but back, you know, in the realm of national treasure years, but
I see what you did there.
Oh, that's a very old trope. Wow, I actually can't believe that National Treasure was only in quotes 13 years ago.
Yeah. And it was before Lord of War.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
But yeah, you can get Lord of War on Amazon. You can rent it or buy it. And it is a Warner Brothers movie, which means if you buy it on Amazon, it should flow out to Movies Anywhere and let you watch it on various other apps. But yeah, it's the one thing before we like close up for the night, the thing that I will say that we've skirted around it a little bit, but it's an important distinction, is that Lord of War does fit into the mold of these other movies in the sense that it's very acerbic, it's very fast paced. They play with a lot of humor. The big difference is it's very black humor. Like, it is aware of the stakes, and it is aware of the consequences, and so it falls much more into the vein of films that you would see with non-white, like anti-heroes or villains, where the criminal, you started out and you just know this person is dealing guns, he's doomed. Like, yep. There is a comeuppance that's built into certain kinds of movies, and usually it's not built into a movie where the main character is rich and white and he's cracking wise. But in the case of Lord of War, it was. And so that is what kind of differentiates this from the other ones, is that as a tool of kind of social discourse, we've talked about how the like crime movies featuring non-white characters tend to drive home this message that, like, you will get caught, you will get punished, it will be awful, submit. And the whole kind of thing that we're punching at here is the fact that, like, rich white guys don't get those movies. Rich white guys get the movie that tells you it will be fun, it will be sexy, you'll maybe go to a country club prison.
I don't know, exactly. But I'm saying, like, I'm not quite sure if people have enough consciousness to, in general, do people really think that? I mean, I guess probably now they do. I feel like Bernie Sanders and kind of like that general consciousness that, you know, white collar criminals don't go to jail. Like, I feel like that's general enough now that people don't get their comeuppance. I mean, the fact that, you know, we have all these different companies in the news, Equifax, BP over the years, like, how many people actually spend time in jail? There's literally a documentary, I think,
the Wall Street bankers that
were literally the only Wall Street bankers who even got prosecuted was some small bank. I feel like it's general consciousness at this point. And I'm curious, not only do I wonder if Wolf of Wall Street or that next film would do as well. I mean, American Made didn't do that well, but I don't think it was, I mean, supposedly that actually is quite good. But I don't think that had anything to do with it. I just think that Tom Cruise can't carry that type of film anymore. So I don't think that necessarily has to do it. Like, I'm sure Mission Impossible will do, you know, $600 million or whatever, but maybe not even that. But I feel like it'll just do it because it's Mission Impossible. It's that type of film that people watch him in. They don't watch him in any other films anymore. But
I don't think they ever really did. I mean,
$40 million. Yeah. It actually is kind of amazing when you, which again is another sidetrack, but we never get on sidetracks, is the, when you actually start looking at like Brad Pitt's box office, you're like, oh my God.
I remember writing a story that when World War Z opened at $75 million, it was the biggest Brad Pitt opening ever. And I think it might've been the only movie where Brad Pitt opened at number one at the box office. He's, when you think about the things that he's been in, like, there's a couple of them that are like bona fide big money hits, but really he's famous for being famous.
Yeah. It's actually fascinating because he's an A-lister. He's a big office star, but I mean, I would bet that fucking Nick Cage has more.
Oh, yeah, easily.
more gross box office. And, you know,
you could probably pile up the National Treasure movies and they would equal probably Brad Pitt's entire career minus World War Z and maybe one other.
Yeah, can't even think of one other. But
Vampire maybe.
Well, no, the crazy thing is if you think about that is, what's your schmuck name from, from Transformers. Like, it's amazing when you think about, the main character in the kid, what's his name?
Sam Witwicky.
Remember the name? You remember his character's name? Because I think literally we're
Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf. I was trying to remember the song Shia LaBeouf. If you haven't seen it, just search Shia LaBeouf on YouTube, and it'll probably be the top hit. Actually, is this fantastic like like creepy play musical thing that they do. Anyway, but if we added, if we ever actually added links in the comments, I'd say we'll add the link in the comments, but we never actually do that. But it's amazing when you look at his box office and you're like, Jesus Christ, he's probably in the top 10.
Yeah.
At least of the last 20 years, just because of the franchises that he's been attached to.
Well, I mean, that's like the conversation about Sam Jackson, where it's like, Samuel L. Jackson probably has never headlined like as the main star of a $100 million movie, but that doesn't matter because he had like supporting roles in The Sixth Sense and 3 Star Wars movies and 9 Avengers movies. Yeah. And like,
although makes me think of the one guy when we were talking about the Marvel, we're talking more about the Marvel films. And there's that one actor that's been, he's been a big character in like, new Star Wars films and like 3 things. I'm like, there's no question. He has a larger box office draw, you could say. You'd be completely bullshitting, but you could say than Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie and Jennifer Aniston and, you know, like any number of, wow, I don't know why I just named those 3 people considering, but.
It's your fan fiction, Zach.
I'm actually on Team Angelina. So anyway, but
she was very good in Hackers.
We should actually
Foxfire for the win.
Yeah, we should actually do you know what would be a good Hackers and another actually white collar criminal that is allowed to be things that that Michael Mann film, Black Hat.
Yeah.
Which was surprisingly a film. It's watchable. I mean, it's literally one of those films. I don't know if you've seen it. Like,
I haven't. No.
It's definitely a Michael Mann film.
Yeah.
But you're like, I'm not quite sure why. Like, you're like watching this film and you're like, it's definitely Michael Mann. There's no question about that. Every single shot is a Michael Mann shot. Every single edit is a Michael. But then every actor in the film, you're like, wait, why are these people in here delivering Michael Mann dialogue? Because you're like, you don't deliver Mike. It's less plausible of a Michael Mann film than Miami Vice was. Which I actually kind of want to watch again now. But anyway. I was a huge, huge Miami Vice fan as a kid. Their TV show, of course. But
yeah. No, we sent it back in time. actually, I think we didn't even have to send it. It was just Jamie Foxx's acting was so over the top that it cracked the universe.
Actually, now I kind of want to be like, what was my first Michael Mann film I saw? but. I was talking to my aunt about we were talking about Die Hard, and I thought that was one of the first films I had seen, but I would have been like 4, which was just not plausible. But literally, my aunt was just like, no, you're thinking of Lethal Weapon. You saw Lethal Weapon 1 in theaters, and I was like, I was 6.
I'm like, yeah,
Jesus Christ, like. How this is like one of those things that like I don't see this happening. I mean, I guess you know, you go to theaters, you got already films, and there's like kids in the theaters all the time, but I'm like, I don't see how like nowadays. I know my sister, I don't think my sister just turned 17 today. I don't think she saw her first R-rated film until she was like 15. And like it just was like up overprotecting parents, overprotecting beyond human comprehension. But anyway. Michael Mann wrote for Starsky and Hutch. That's interesting.
Nice.
But anyway, we are way off the trail. I don't know if we have anything else to add.
No, I think that's pretty much it. Again, this is one of those high concepts that just felt like it was worth a talk because I've never actually heard anybody like have this conversation about the fact that like, yeah, we just kind of take for granted that like rich white dudes are allowed to be cool, sexy villains that get away with it.
Yeah. Because there is a ton of white villains who don't get this.
Right.
Obviously. But it seems to be an exclusive thing that that only white villains. I mean, there are, again, there's, but the few that I can think of, you know, I mean, like you mentioned the Equalizer, Denzel Washington, like he, not only does he kind of get away with it, like he's shot. I mean, like he ends that film where, you know, but it's not really that sort of film. It's not, not only is it not based on a true story, at least I don't believe so. But it's also, it's not, you know, he's not played to be the lovable character. He's played to be like the grumpy old bastard, which is kind of what Denzel Washington has played for the last 10 years or so now, which I personally love. Man on Fire is one of my favorite films for some reason.
I remember joking because I hated Dakota Fanning. She just annoyed the crap out of me in whatever else I had seen her in, but up to that point. And I just, somebody came in and was like, oh, have you seen this? This is great at the video store. And I was like, I tell you what, I'll watch that movie if the little girl dies at the end. And
Jesus Christ.
And they were like, she does. And I was like, damn it, now I got to watch that movie.
Wait, no, she doesn't.
I never watched it, so I
Well, no, she doesn't. Adele's give you spoilers. Spoilers for Man on Fire. But no, Denzel Washington trades his life, even though he's already like literally bleeding out. So trades his life for her, for her life. But how do you hate to?
I don't remember what it, probably because Uptown Girls had just come out. And
well, so she was like seven in Man on Fire. How did you hate her before? You're like, I hated Sofia Coppola. In
Godfather, you know what too. It was?
Fuck her.
You know what it was? It was War of the Worlds.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I can see that. But that was, I think that was the film. I mean, like,
I feel like we've said more words about War of the Worlds than any critic in the last 10 years.
Probably. Because, I mean, it is, I mean, that is, you know, we should actually, now that, actually, you know, our next thing that we should do, and we literally should, could probably just be like, cut and start, which I'm not necessarily against. I just have to get some more ice. I have like a little bit left. Is, you know, now that there's this Spielberg documentary out and we're kind of recircling back to this weird love affair with Spielberg, kind of ignoring the last decade where he hasn't produced a single watchable film. Even if it wasn't Spielberg, I don't think his films like would be watchable, not even on the Spielberg scale. It is amazing that there are certain films that you're like, oh yeah, shit. That was exists. Fucking Spielberg. Like that's, it wasn't just War of the Worlds, which probably upon itself should be like a film that you'd remember because it's a big, it inherently a big fucking film and, you know, and whatever. But like, oh my God, that was Tom Cruise, you know, Dakota. I mean, it was like, I had a lot of big names in it. Tim Robbins.
Yeah. Tim Robbins. Yeah.
But,
in his totally bizarre role as
like crazy guy, number five,
crazy guy.
Yeah. but yeah, I don't, yeah.
So yeah, anyway, the we didn't really review stuff so much as just talk about stuff, which actually I think that just kind of, I think that when it's just you and me, unless we have like a really solid, like, oh shit, we really want to talk about this film, like this format works a little bit better because we end up on tangents anyway. So having a kind of a looser, like having a looser mission statement.
I mean,
allows
I don't know. I personally have never gotten, and whether we include this in the show or not, I never really gotten the whole like review a film that's 20 years old thing.
Yeah.
Like the only reason that it's worth talking about is within the context of, is it watchable now?
Yeah.
Not, is it a great film? I mean, unless I'm writing a film essay or some shit, or it's, you know, I mean, or it's the classics, you know, it's a Criterion Collection or something like that type of film where it's like, okay, no, let's actually talk about this film and analyze it. But I mean, also, you know, let's, what are we going to analyze fucking War Dogs? I mean, like, it was the film. It was a film like Catch Me If You Can. It was talked about enough. And again, like every fucking Spielberg film of at least the last 15 years, 20 years, it was over glorified and over worshipped for what it was. And, you know, like, it was a serviceable Spielberg film. That's what it was. but with Tom Hanks, because it's mandatory that we have the Tom Hanks. You know,
it is.
We cannot say bad things about Tom Hanks. It is not allowable.
I don't know. I seem to remember you saying plenty of bad things about Tom Hanks.
I gotta find that. I think on that pile of papers somewhere back there is that script I wrote about Pitt Film School. My one script that I wrote that about two Catholic schoolboys sitting on the stoop of a cathedral talking about how they get STDs from their from their priests and nuns, and then wildly going off on a terrific direction with no foreseeable reason to about how much they hate Tom Hanks. There was a transition because they were talking about AIDS, and then Philadelphia came up, and then Tom Hanks.
That's right.
Then there was, of course, the scene where he's complaining. He's like, I love Joe versus the Volcano. That did $33 million at the box office. One note I had from Howard, my massive award-winning writing teacher, the guy literally written 77 films, mm-hmm. and love him more than anything else. He destroyed my writing on a daily basis, made me want to become a photographer more than anybody probably else, because he convinced me, no, you can't be a writer, which is probably a good idea. I'd be really writing for some sitcom right now. But he, like the one note was, I don't believe that, or so, at least maybe it wasn't him, maybe it was somebody in the class, but it's like, yeah. I don't believe that a 12-year-old would know the box office of Jones the Volcano. And I'm like, well, there's where you're wrong, son. I'm like, I know for a fact that I did that as a kid. Maybe not at 15, or maybe not at 13, but like at 15, once the moment that IMDb became a thing, not even IMDb, I think there's probably some other Box Office Mojo, who, you know, they haven't changed the template of their website since 1984. It's still the same tech, which it works, so
yeah,
it's still more serviceable than fucking than IMDb is now, so
yeah.
But anyway,
but yeah, so thank you, anybody who's listening to this our insane ramblings.
So thanks, Michelle, how you doing?
Especially because she won't be able to listen to the fucking terrible audio of Archie Digest tomorrow. So before I go to bed, I'll put this on the Patreon page.
Google.
But you're right. Tomorrow we should try to do
a Spielbergo.
A Spielberg thing. So. All right, sir. I will see you in the morning.
Talk to you later, man.